that are collaborating with AMISOM in the intention that they are made ready to be handing over from AMISOM when we are transitioning.
Dardargelin fara badan inuu keeno taas oon cashra inaan bixinno muhiim ah oon gadaal ku sii bixinno oon sii qaybinno inay suura gasho.
Mr. Azikiwe, the African Union troops are expected to complete their mission in Somalia later this year. Now, is Somalia ready to take care of its security?
No, it doesn't appear that that is the case. This is something that's been discussed for several years now, and it remains to be seen if they actually pull out. Because with the political stalemate that's going on right now within the federal government in Somalia, it's highly unlikely that a withdrawal of AMISOM forces at this point will result in any type of stability in the country. So we need to follow the situation very closely between now and the end of the year.
Thanks for that insight, Mr. Azikiwe. Now, here at Africa Today, we shall continue monitoring the situation in Somalia and keep you posted as it unfolds.
African startups defy pandemic.
Despite the COVID-19 outbreak, African tech startups raised a record high of $700 million from investors in 2020. Now, this is according to the African Tech Startups Funding 2020 report released by Disrupt Africa.
According to the report, 2020 was a record year for investment into the African tech startup ecosystem, with more startups raising more money from more investors than ever before. The report details how Kenya, Nigeria, South Africa, and Egypt are the premier investment destinations on the continent, though funding is also on the rise elsewhere. One of the leading startups which attracted investments last year is Nigeria's Okada e-hailing firm. The founder of the firm speaks here on his venture. Let's take a listen.
My name is Tayo. I'm the co-founder and CEO of Metro Africa Express, aka Max.ng. We run a company that provides app-based mobility to small businesses, to individuals, and to commuters in cities like Lagos, Accra, and we're gradually expanding and launching other cities in West Africa. Mobility and last-mile logistics, and logistics in general, is one of the biggest challenges that Africa faces today. And at the heart of economic development and economic growth and prosperity for our people, anywhere in the world is a very efficient and affordable and accessible logistics and mobility system. And how Max is bridging that gap in Africa today is, of course, by leveraging mobile technology to connect users with providers. Beyond that also is the fact that we're taking away friction. So payments, for example, integrating with companies like Followweb allows us to take away a lot of cash-based payments, improve security, because drivers moving around with cash also makes them targets for thieves, right? So eliminating all of that is extremely important in ensuring and guaranteeing security. And last but not least, also is a lot of the work we do around financing drivers, providing them access to credit to be able to own their own motorcycles and their vehicles over a short period of time, and also providing them training that is so important.
Now, for more analysis on the rapid rise of African startups, we have contacted Musach Obioha, the Executive Director of Ventures Platform Foundation, and Mr. Amin Yusuf, the co-founder of Afrobytes, an international tech marketplace connecting businesses and technology leaders, founders, investors, policy experts, and the media with the African tech industry. Now, thanks a lot, gentlemen, for your time. Let's start off with Mr. Obioha. Now, what's the reason behind the resounding success by African startups?
The first is, so Africa is a very large market. Beyond the size of the market, there's been a lot of underdevelopment in most of Africa. which also presents huge opportunities. Technically, if you know anything about entrepreneurs, is entrepreneurship is all about solving problems and wrapping sustainable business models around the solutions to those problems. So anywhere you see a lot of problems, the tendency is to see a lot of entrepreneurship and a lot of resilience and a lot of people trying to create innovative solutions and wrapping business models around those solutions. So for Africa, having a plethora of problems and having huge human capital, it just clearly means that there's going to be a lot of solutions coming out and people innovating and creating these types of solutions. So that's one of the reasons why there's been a boom with innovation entrepreneurship ecosystem in Africa, and having lots of startups coming up. I think also the availability of digital penetration through telecommunications companies also has made it possible to have information spread super fast, have communication happen super fast.
Thanks for that. Now, what makes African startups attractive to foreign investors, and what potential do they see here?
They are looking for new frontiers and new markets, and Africa looks like a very great place to be, a very great place to invest. And for them, it's not about preaching, it's more like preaching to the choir, because they already see the potential of those types of investment in their own markets. While here, for many local investors, it's quite foreign for them to understand how you could own a little amount of equity in a startup and startup can grow super fast, and then be able to exit either through an acquisition. And one of the very interesting examples is how recently Paystack exited with an acquisition from Stripe at $200 million after just about 5 years of operation. Now, a traditional investor would not be able to understand how someone can build a company in 5 years and exit at $200 million, or how today Flutterwave, which is another fintech startup in Nigeria, is also worth over $1 billion. So these are concepts that have been quite difficult for local investors to comprehend and to grasp. And that's why platforms like my platform, one of the things that we do actively is we try to get traditional investors and teach them and try to educate them on the innovation and startup ecosystem and how investment here is done and how the upsides can be incredible.
In Africa, digital innovation is transforming the agriculture by improving food production, providing agribusiness opportunities, and making agriculture attractive for young people seeking employment as well. The Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations is involved in a project that has developed apps for smart farming in some African countries. Let's see how one of the apps works for farmers.
In Rwanda and Senegal, the FAO has partnered with local farmers and innovators to develop and pilot 4 new mobile apps that are making a difference in the lives and livelihoods of farmers. The 4 apps have voice and text features and can be used on smart and feature phones. The first app, called Cure and Feed Your Livestock, provides farmers with real-time information and advice on animal disease control and animal feeding strategies. It includes a vaccination calendar and a list of local veterinarians and shows water points and pasture
maps. Mr. Obioha, can you elaborate on how some of these startups are having direct impact on the lives of African people?
These startups are able to create solutions that are now affecting the lives of many people, whether it's in payment or it's in healthcare. One incredible startup that I heard about recently is MDAS. They've been able to create this well-equipped medical diagnostic centers, but using refurbished equipment. But what they've also done is they're able to service multiple hospitals. So while one hospital has equipment for their own customer base, which is quite limited, what they've been able to do is aggregate a lot of hospitals to use one medical center or one diagnostic center. And what this has been able to do is it's increased the number of people that can access medical diagnostic services, but also has reduced the price of those services, therefore getting in more access to more people.
Now, that's great. African startups are improving the lives of African people. That's another reason to be hopeful about Africa's future. Let's now bring in Mr. Amin Yusuf, a co-founder of Afrobytes. Thanks a lot for your time, Mr. Yusuf. Now, how is the increase in new business startups in Africa helping ordinary people improve their livelihoods?
I think the first sector, I'm thinking about is basically finance and access to finance, access to banking. Take the example of Kenya. They had a problem of unbanked people. And when the mobile money came, it helped a lot of people to be financially included. That means more transactions, that means more payments, that means that they had access to goods, so that was very important. And for example, now, I think that the volume of transactions in fintech in Kenya is more than 50% of the GDP. That's just really huge.
Now, what are some of the major challenges that African startups have faced over the past year?
Okay. So I think one of the bigger challenges that they faced wasn't even the pandemic itself, but was like the restrictions that came with the pandemic. And those more nuanced effects have affected a lot of startups. One is spending patterns of people changed because people had new priorities, so people were not buying what they used to buy before. So a lot of startups have had to try to better understand their customer base now to figure out where to pivot to. Another thing was the lockdown was really brutal on Nigeria, for one, because a lot of people lost livelihoods, a lot of businesses shut down, a lot of people lost their jobs, and so the purchasing power of many of the people reduced, which also meant that they were not able to buy the normal services that they would normally purchase, which automatically reduced the amount of money that the startups could make, which obviously affected them negatively.
Tibu Health, a Kenyan health startup, is a classic case turning threats into opportunities. This app is gaining popularity in the country's capital, Nairobi, for providing home-based medical care. Tibu app was launched nearly 1 year ago at the early stages of the COVID-19 pandemic that forced many to stay at home. Let's have a look.
The age of the app means taxis and takeaways can be brought to your door at the touch of a button. But in a home in Nairobi, Natalie Maikere is requesting a different home delivery. Via Tibu's Health app, she's just ordered a doctor.
What I really like about it is it takes 15, 30 minutes. So when the first time I used it, it was for me. Normally, I never go to the hospital because it takes too much time. But this time, I didn't hesitate. I was like, oh, this is easy. I just call a doctor and it comes.
Have you ever had this headache before?
With 600 customers in Nairobi, Tibu is a small player in a global movement towards home-based medical care.
Despite the lockdown and job losses, several startups made massive profits. How was this possible?
For some businesses, it was super positive for them, especially businesses around remittances or businesses that were into foreign investments in Nigeria. So we saw some of those companies increase and grow in revenue. And by one program that we were running, the FinTech Accelerator program, we had one of the companies there that was into remittances and into international investments, and they grew from less than $10,000 in assets under management over $2 million in about 2 to 3 months.
Well, from our conversation today, it's quite clear that Africa is a new frontier for startups. The population there is young and eager to embrace new technologies, and this creates a great opportunity for startups. That wraps it up for this week's edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you, and on behalf of my colleagues here at Africa Today, it's goodbye for now.
The limelight.
Canada likes to see itself as a benign global actor, but
its extensive history of military intervention tells a different story. A $70 billion upgrade of the Canadian Navy, now carried out by Justin Trudeau, will strengthen its capacity for military action as a U.S. sidekick in world affairs, says Yves Engler, writer in an article titled, "The Canadian Government Talks About Peace, But It's Investing in War." Stay tuned, please, for the details. Canada has marketed itself for many years as a peacekeeping nation and benevolent international actor, but this appearance is only plausible if one's point of comparison lies directly south of the border. The Canadian state has long had a privileged relationship with the United States and Britain, the two leading empires of the last two centuries. In reality, its appearance as a tender-hearted broker in international affairs is a public relations sleight of hand. Ottawa has deployed its relatively sophisticated military in action far more often than most people recognize. Canada is now preparing to equip its navy with new frigates at an estimated cost of $70 billion, $100 billion over their life cycle. As part of the largest single outlay of public money in Canadian history, the 15 vessels will be kitted out with a mixture of offensive and defensive weapons, in a mix never seen before any surface combatant. Thus far, this expenditure has not elicited any paramilitary opposition. The 7,800 metric ton vessels have space for a helicopter and remotely piloted systems. The frigates have electronic warfare capabilities, torpedo tubes, and various high-powered guns. They will also possess naval strike missile harpoons that can fire missiles from a distance of 185 kilometers. Most controversially, the surface combatant looks set to be equipped with Tomahawk cruise missiles capable of striking land targets up to 1,700 kilometers away. The U.S.-based firm Raytheon has only ever exported these Tomahawk missiles to the U.K. If the Royal Canadian Navy acquires them, it will be the only navy besides the United States to deploy the missiles on surface vessels. Canada's new frigate will be brimming with missiles, is how the drive recently described the surface combatant vessels. In the article, War Zone reporter Joseph Trevithick concludes that the ships now look set to offer Canada an entirely new form of maritime power projection. Over the past 3 years, Canadian vessels have repeatedly been involved in belligerent freedom of navigation through international waters claimed by Beijing in the South China Sea, Strait of Taiwan, and East China Sea. To counter China's growing influence in Asia, Washington has stuck its oar into long-standing territorial and maritime boundary disputes between China and the Philippines, Malaysia, Vietnam, and other nations. As part of these efforts to rally regional opposition to China, the U.S. Navy has engaged in regular FON operations, which see warships travel through or near disputed waters. Canadian frigates have also regularly patrolled the Black Sea, which borders Russia, Bulgaria, Turkey, Romania, Georgia, and Ukraine. In July 2019, HMCS Tirreno led a four-ship standing NATO maritime group exercise in the Black Sea. Soon afterward, it participated with 24 other ships in a NATO exercise that included training in maritime interdiction, air defense, amphibious warfare, and anti-submarine warfare as part of an effort to send a strong message of deterrence to Russia. During the 2011 war on Libya, Canadian vessels patrolled the Libyan coast. Two rotations of Canadian naval vessels enforced a six-month blockade of the North African country. On May 19, 2011, HMCS Charlottetown joined an operation that destroyed eight Libyan naval vessels. After the conflict, Navy head Paul Madison told Ottawa defense contractors that Charlottetown played a key role in keeping the port of Misrata open as a critical enabler of the anti-Qazafi forces. A month before the March 2003 U.S.-led invasion of Iraq commenced, Canada sent a command and control destroyer to the Persian Gulf to take charge of Task Force 151, the Joint Allied Naval Command. Opinion sought by the Liberal government at the time concluded that taking command of Task Force 151 could constitute being legally at war with Iraq. Throughout the 1990s, Canadian warships were part of U.S. carrier battle groups enforcing brutal sanctions on Iraq. And in 1998, HMCS Tirreno was deployed to support U.S. airstrikes. During the first Iraq war, Canada dispatched destroyers HMCS Terra Nova and Athabascan and supply vessel Protector to the Persian Gulf before a UN resolution was passed. Historically, the Canadian Navy's influence has been greatest near to home. There is a long track record of naval interventions in the Americas. As military historian Sean Maloney states, since 1960, Canada has used its military forces at least 26 times in the Caribbean to support Canadian foreign policy. In addition, Canada planned three additional operations, including two unilateral interventions into the Caribbean states. At the request of Grenada's government, Ottawa deployed a vessel to the tiny country during its 1974 independence celebration. As Kai Schoenholz and Richard Melanson describe in their book, Revolution and Intervention in Grenada, Canada and the UK also sent three armed vessels to St. George to shore up the Eric Gehry government, which faced significant pressure from the Grenada left. When the 23,000 U.S. troops invaded the Dominican Republic in April 1965, a Canadian warship was sent to Santo Domingo. Paul Theodore Haller, Canada's Minister of Defense at the time, explained that this deployment was in order for Canada to stand by case it is required. Two Canadian gunboats were also deployed to the independence celebration in Barbados the following year, a bizarre diplomatic maneuver that was designed to demonstrate Canada's military prowess. According to a Canadian War Museum exhibition, during the war, Canadians became especially good at train busting. This meant running in close to shore, usually at night, and risking damage from Chinese and North Korean artillery in order to destroy trains or tunnels on Korea's coastal railway. Of the 28 trains destroyed by United Nations warships in Korea, Canadian vessels claimed 8. The official record Canadian naval operations in Korean waters 1950 to 1955 details a large number of RCN attacks that would have likely killed civilians. Further back in time, Canadian warships were also dispatched to force Costa Rica to negotiate with the Royal Bank in 1921 a Protect British interest during the Mexican Revolution and back to dictator massacring peasants in El Salvador in 1932. Where do Canada's political parties stand on the new frigates brimming with missiles? It was Stephen Harper's Conservatives who instigated this massive naval expenditure, while the Liberals have happily continued down the same path. For its part, the center-left New Democratic Party has yet to object to the initiative, while the Bloc Québéco has simply pressed for more shipyard work in Quebec. Canada's real track record in world affairs bears very little resemblance to the smug and self-satisfied stories it tells about itself. Instead of proffering olive branches, it is spending $100 billion to strengthen its Navy capacity for throwing its weight around, all in support of U.S. imperialism and Canadian corporations abroad. And with no sign of dissent coming from the Canadian political class, that pattern of duplicity looks set to continue.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, treating poverty. Teaching people to believe truly that provision comes from Allah and that He is the provider, Ar-Razzaq, and every calamity that Allah decrees is for a reason, and that the poor Muslim should be patient in bearing his calamity and strive to relieve himself and his family of poverty. Allah says, verily, Allah is the all-provider, owner of power, the most strong. This is chapter 51, verse number 58. Then another place Allah says, and no moving or living creature is there on earth, but its provision is due from Allah, and He knows its dwelling place and its deposit in the uterus or grave. Then Allah says, He it is who has made the earth subservient to you, that is, easy for you to walk, to live, and to do agriculture on it. So walk in the path thereof and eat of his provision, and to him will be the resurrection. This is chapter 67, verse number 15. Brothers and sisters, we need to realize that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is in charge. We need to do the needful, we need to make an effort, and we need to fulfill our responsibility. But in reality, it's Allah who provides us with sustenance. It's not our efforts alone. It's not our struggles alone. It's not our academics alone. It's not my job. It's not my paycheck. Allah is the one who provides the provisions to all the creatures and not just to human beings. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing treating poverty, and we said reliance on Allah and knowing in reality that if we fulfill our responsibility, Allah will take care of us. This is what we are discussing. Now, Allah has granted the poor a share of Islamic taxes, which is to be given to the poor to keep and is to be given until he becomes independent of means and is no longer poor. Generally speaking, it's the responsibility of an Islamic government, of an Islamic system, to collect those taxes and disperse them and distribute them amongst the needy and the poor and the less fortunate people who deserve that help. O you who believe, fear Allah and give up what remains due to you from riba, from now onwards, if you are really believers. The Muslim knows that poverty and richness and whether things are given to one or withheld are all subject to decree of Allah. So he bears hardships with patience when they come, and he thanks Allah, may he be exalted, for good times when he finds them. But he is required to work and seek to earn a living so as to relieve himself and his family of poverty. But if someone is unable to do that because of health reasons or problems in his land, then Islam relieves him of poverty by means of Islamic taxes and charity that are given by the rich. This is the share of their wealth that the poor are entitled to. This is what Islam proposes. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
A national non-profit revealed that testing commissioned by the group, as well as separate analysis conducted by Massachusetts officials, show samples of an aerially sprayed pesticide used by the Commonwealth and at least 25 other states to control mosquito-borne illnesses contain toxic substances that critics called forever chemicals. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jessica Corbett Ryder. This article is published under the heading "Test Reveal Toxic Forever Chemicals in Aerial Pesticide Showered Over Millions of Acres in the United States." Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. We'll be right back. a national nonprofit, revealed that testing commissioned by the group, as well as separate analyses conducted by Massachusetts officials, show samples of an aerially sprayed pesticide used by the Commonwealth and at least 25 other states to control mosquito-borne illnesses contain toxic substances that critics call forever chemicals. Officially known as PFAS and polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS, this group of man-made chemicals, including PFOA, PFOS, and GenX, earned the nickname because they do not break down in the environment and build up in the body. PFAS has been linked to suppressed immune function, cancers, and other health issues. Lawmakers and regulators at various levels of government have worked to clean up drinking water contaminated by PFAS. The newly released results of pesticide testing by public employees for environmental responsibility, or PEER, and the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection, MADEP, generated alarm about the effectiveness of such efforts. In Massachusetts, communities are struggling to remove PFAS from their drinking water supplies, while at the same time, we may be showering them with PFAS from the skies and roads. PEER Science Policy Director Kyla Bennett, a scientist and attorney formerly with U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, said in a statement on Tuesday, December 1st. The frightening thing is that we do not know how many insecticides, herbicides, or even disinfectants contain PFAS, added Bennett, who arranged for the testing. PEER found patents showing chemical companies using PFAS in these products, and recent articles discusses the variety of pesticides that contain PFAS as either an active or an inert ingredient. The product tested initially by PEER and subsequently MADEP, once the nonprofit alerted the department of its findings, is Anvil 10+1, produced by the Illinois company Clark. Karen Larson, Clark's vice president of government affairs, told the Boston Globe that when this was first brought to our attention, we conducted an internal inquiry of our manufacturing and supply chain to ensure that PFAS was not an ingredient in the production, manufacturing, or distribution of either the active or inactive ingredients of Anvil. No PFAS ingredients are used in the formulation of Anvil, nor in the production of any source material in Anvil. PFAS components are not added at any point in the production of Anvil, she said. Larson added that while it is unclear why the Clark pesticide contained PFAS, the company will continue to work closely with the EPA to conduct the testing. PEER Executive Director Tim Whitehouse detailed the recent testing results in a letter sent last week to MADEP Commissioner Martin Suberg that called for the halting use of Anvil 10+10, ensuring any replacement does not contain forever chemicals, and requiring pesticide companies to comprehensively test their products for PFAS. This fall, PEER conducted several tests for PFAS of a 2.5-gallon jug of Anvil 10+10, the pesticide used in aerial spraying programs of Massachusetts and many other states across the United States of America. The test revealed that Anvil 10+10 contains roughly 250 parts per trillion of perfluorooctanic acid, that is PFOA, and 260 to 500 ppt of hexafluoroproline. propylene oxide dimer acid, that is HFPODA, a Gen X replacement for PFOA. Both these results are hovering around the detection limits of the laboratory's equipment, but there is no doubt that these PFAS are in the intesticide. While PFAS may be useful when added to pesticides as surfactants, dispersants, and anti-foaming agents, it is unclear whether the PFAS found in Anvil 10 plus 10 is an ingredient added by the manufacturer, contained in one of the ingredients supplied to Anvil's manufacturer by other companies, or whether it is a containment from the manufacturing storage process. Moreover, since we were only able to test for 36 PFAS out of the 9,252 on the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's inventory, it is impossible to know how many other PFAS might be in the Anvil 10 plus 10, the researchers added. When PEER obtained its first positive PFAS results on Anvil 10 plus 1, we immediately contacted DEP because of the far-reaching implications, the researchers said. MADEP independently tested 9 samples of Anvil 10 plus 10 from 5 different containers and found 8 different PFAS, including PFOA and PFOS. Some PFAS levels were over 700 ppt. As such, there appears to be no doubt that there are PFAS in the pesticide Massachusetts has chosen for mosquito control. White House noted that Massachusetts aerially sprayed 2.2 million acres with Anvil 10 plus 10 last year and more than 200,000 acres this year. The Globe explained that most of the spraying has been done in southeastern part of the state where EEE, a rare but deadly mosquito-borne disease, has been most prevalent. The EPA, which has been lambasted by lawmakers as well as environmental and public health advocates for its handling of PFAS contamination on a national scale, is working on an analytical method to detect the forever chemicals in pesticides and plans to conduct its own tests of Anvil 10 plus 10, according to the newspaper. There are significant unanswered questions about the data currently available, Dave Deegan, a spokesperson for the federal agency's offices in New England, told the Globe. EPA will continue to work closely with and support the state on the issue. Bennett and other critics of the EPA's response to PFAS reiterated concerns about the agency in the wake of their revelations in Massachusetts. In a statement about the testing on Tuesday, December 1st, Food and Water Watch Executive Director Vino Hatter declared that these findings shocked the conscience. States likely have unknowingly contaminated communities' water with PFAS hidden in pesticides. Once again, the EPA has failed to protect the American people from harmful pollution. Emphasizing that we need to stop the introduction of toxic forever chemicals into the environment and the water sources to protect public health, Hatter said that EPA must ban all pesticides with PFAS components, designate PFAS as hazardous substances to hold polluters accountable for cleanup of contamination, and set strong, enforceable standards for PFAS in the drinking waters in the U.S. The GOP-controlled Senate must step up and pass the PFAS Action Act, which passed the House in January, to regulate these toxic compounds and hold polluters accountable. And U.S. Congress must pass the Water Act to provide the financial relief to community water providers and households which wells to remove PFAS from drinking water or find alternative sources where treatment fails, she added. Now is the time for decisive action to protect people's health and safety.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on March 21st, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Nowruz. Having competent managers and benefiting from capacities are necessary conditions for economic blossoming.
I want to say to the Iranian nation that because of some problems in the economic situation and in the people's livelihood conditions, some individuals have used the opportunity to fabricate negative stories, saying things such as nothing can be done in any way. Some people are like this. Some individuals in cyberspace, in our press, and primarily, and unfortunately in foreign propaganda networks, use the problems that the people face as a means to portray a completely dark picture of the things conveying the feeling that nothing can be done. However, I will tell you that this is not all the case. With its domestic capacities and capabilities, our economy can be one of the most prospering economies in the region and even in the world. We have many capacities. We have numerous resources, and using these resources does not require any miracle whatsoever. These are the issues which could be resolved by officials and managers with determination, a sense of responsibility, and great endeavor.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
The condition for this is to have strong and anti-corruption management in the country as well as comprehensive economic plan. If these things exist, then these capacities should be exploited. The World Bank experts are saying now, it is not what we claim. Rather, this is being said by well-known and first-tier economists in the world, working as experts for the World Bank, that Iran's economy is 18th among the best economies in the world. In other words, we are the 18th economy among 200-plus countries in the world, and that has been achieved despite the current sanctions and numerous problems. They say that if untapped capacities are used, later on, I will mention these capacities, Iran's economy will move up 6 spots, rising to the 12th position. This is a very important point. With an 80-plus million population, and despite all these problems that others have imposed on us, sanctions and the like, the country is thankfully alive and up and running, and it is also the 18th economy in the world. This is not a minor achievement. We should pay attention to this.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
Around the world with reporters.
As United States President Joe Biden keeps failing to honor his campaign promise to quickly undo the damage wrought by his predecessor on relations with Iran, Washington is grappling with the reality that it's now a very different geopolitical world. The just-signed $400 billion 25-year Iran-China pact, which China's foreign minister called permanent, has been received with shock and awe across the Beltway. Washington's long-standing effort to totally isolate and blockade Iran has formally failed, while China's new ally provides a major energy obstacle to the Pentagon's militaristic pivot to Asia policy.
The foreign policy of the United States really does not change under Democrats or Republicans very much. So there's agreement in that area of the oligarchy on foreign policy. And foreign policy really is based on controlling basically the world.
The Economic and Security Alliance worsens the leverage of the United States, but they have repeatedly undermined their own bargaining position. In 2018, the United States illegally and unilaterally pulled out of the JCPOA pact on Iran's nuclear energy program and then began reimposing crippling economic sanctions designed to force Iran to renegotiate. Tehran insists compliance with the original pact is the only way forward and reiterated that the deal is still on the table if Biden returns the U.S. into compliance.
What should he do with Iran is he should get back into the agreement that Obama made, and we should be working with them to relieve the sanctions. They've actually done everything that the United States required of them. It's the foreign policy of the United States is totally immoral. So it's immoral towards Iran, as it is in many other places.
Iranian President Hassan Rouhani recently said that the lack of knowledge about Iran from American officials is ridiculous. Many analysts have been dumbfounded by the formal alliance. It's what many Americans now call woke, as it's between two nations of different colors, ethnicities, cultures, and cosmologies. Top American media is saying the next few weeks are make or break for the JCPOA, at least until September. The Biden administration is reportedly scrambling to present a new offer to Tehran as soon as next week. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
As the Yemeni army is pushing ahead with its offensive to liberate the city of Marib from Saudi-backed forces, Yemen's bloc of anti-aggression parties has held an event in the capital Sana'a to discuss the role of the southern and eastern Yemeni tribes in facing the Saudi-led coalition.
Many of the free people in southern Yemen stand beside their country in groups and parties, but they face severe repression from the forces of the coalition in southern regions, which confirms the ugliness of the crimes committed by the coalition against Yemenis. All Yemenis should be working together on a comprehensive plan to liberate all governorates after the liberation of Marib.
Since the beginning of the Saudi war in Yemen, eastern and western tribes played a key role in supporting the Yemeni army with weapons, money, and fighters. The participants say the tribes devoted their efforts to expel the foreign presence from their country.
The southern and eastern Yemeni tribes have many honorable stances, whether by spreading culture and awareness or supporting the political position inside and outside Yemen. They are also supporting the fronts of confrontation with weapons, men, money, and sending food convoys to the fighters on all fronts. The tribes are seeking to expel the foreign occupation from the country.
The Yemeni army has recently intensified its operations to liberate Marib, the last stronghold of the Saudi-backed forces in northern Yemen, a move which considered as the first step forward for liberating the rest of the country.
Yemenis agree that the liberation of the country will not succeed without the tribes backing the army, since the tribes themselves refuse the presence of any foreign forces, especially those of Saudi Arabia. Abdul Latif Roshali, Sana'a.
The Commission on Race and Ethnic Disparities says the UK system is not rigged against people from ethnic minorities and there is no proof of institutional racism. In a report released Wednesday, it did admit that minorities still face overt racism, but insisted Britain should be regarded as a, quote, model for other white majority countries.
The report definitely touched a nerve, suggesting that disparities based on race in the economy and education are negligible. But people here in Brixton definitely disagree.
They live in their little tower and they've grown up in a certain way, but they don't see the reality of what black people are actually going through. So no, there is racism and we are not hung up. We need to just be heard that something is wrong with our bringing up our lives and how we are actually treated, because in reality we are seen as a different color.
Institutional racism does exist. It exists in the education system everywhere. You can see it in a classroom. A teacher would discriminate against a black student over a white student just because he's black.
The report has been slammed as nonsense that flies in the face of all existing evidence. Flagged up are many issues that black and minority ethnics grapple on a daily basis. For example, the fact that black people are 9 times more likely to be stopped and searched by police than white people, and black mothers are 4 times likely to die in childbirth. So is this a genuine effort to understand racism in Britain, or a PR stunt? Many black artists share the view that racism today is alive and well. Junior from the British Collective says his life and career were deeply impacted by racism.
When I was a kid and I was growing up, if I played football and a white guy kicked me, I would have turned around and I might have effed him blind. But it wouldn't have crossed my mind to call him white. Vice versa, the first thing that he would do is turn around and say, "You black so-and-so." Not understanding for himself that he's being racist, he just took it as the norm. It hasn't changed since then. It hasn't changed in any shape, form, or fashion. I hear some politicians trying to turn it into black politicians trying to turn it into a, oh, well, we've come a long way.